From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The family in Isabel Allende's new novel, Maya's Notebook, is about as global as it gets. Young Maya has a Chilean father, a Danish mother, an American immigrant grandmother, an African-American step-grandfather who raises her. And when he dies, she's in trouble. The grandmother sends her American granddaughter back to Chile to find her heart, her soul. This hour on Point, Isabel Allende on youth, wisdom, old countries, and her new novel, Maya's Notebook. You can join us on air or online. Are you an Allende reader? Can you picture her on crime, drugs, street life, porn, and the old country? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. This conversation never ends. Later this hour, we'll listen back on a conversation we had with singer and Woodstock icon Richie Havens, who died yesterday at 72. But first, from San Francisco, Isabel Allende joins us, prolific, internationally best-selling author, feminist, grandmother, famed for her historical novels. Her latest is right up to date, echoing a bit off the Tsarnaev brother headlines of immigration, alienation, old country. It is Maya's Notebook. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Isabel Allende, welcome back to On Point. It's so nice to have you.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Now, I know you write in Spanish before you write in English, so your Spanish readers will have had a whack at this 2 or 3 years ago. Now we've got it in English, so it's distant from our headlines. But it's attention-grabbing right off the bat because this is not a historical novel at all, though a little history sneaks in here. What brought you so up to date, Isabel?
Yeah, it's a very contemporary novel. I was just fed up with research. I had been writing historical novels and studying and researching for years. I thought, oh my God, I was so tired. So I decided to write something that was contemporary, that didn't need much research, that I knew about. And at the time, I was surrounded. I wrote the book in 2010. I was surrounded by teenagers. So the book is about a 19-year-old girl from Berkeley, like any of the kids that were around me at the time. And she loses her family at a very vulnerable age and gets in trouble. And I thought, well, that could happen to any of the kids that I know.
You've dedicated this book to the teenagers of my tribe, you say. And reel off those six for us, Alejandro, Andrea, and who else?
They are all, the six of them, except one who is in high school. The others are all in college. They survive the teenage years. Well, I don't know
your grandchildren, Nicole, Sabrina, Aristoteles, Achilles?
Achilles.
Yeah.
Yeah, the father was Greek. That's why they have those names.
Okay. And those are your six grandchildren?
Well, some of them are biological grandchildren, some of them are sort of adopted grandchildren.
Yeah, and I guess they become, they were your research, just seeing them, knowing
them,
living
research,
with them.
They were my research, and you know what, they also, I wrote the book asking them, so it was an ongoing conversation with them about how they see the world, what they want, what they think, what they fear. And I was terrified for them because they were exposed to everything that I never was exposed to or my children. So I feared for them at the time.
Put yourself into this book. You're right there, I guess, in the character of the grandmother, Nini, who is looking at this granddaughter, Maya, and feeling exactly the fear you describe.
Yeah, and it's a tough grandmother, a loving grandmother, weird, with a Chilean background like myself. I didn't have to invent her. I was there.
And she's an immigrant to the United States, so she's got the same Chilean-American background as you.
Exactly. She's the kind of grandmother that will slap her, and the kid will say, I will call 911. Yeah, you call 911, you stupid brat.
You've got it right up to date in all of its diversity here. I mean, she early on in her life falls in love with a wonderful African-American astronomer who's very prominent in
From Berkeley,
who stares out at the heavens. Maya, this is the grandmother, the granddaughter's father, a Chilean airline pilot, her mother, a Danish air hostess who disappears pretty quickly, leaves the baby off at the grandmother's doorstep here.
Yeah, really, I needed to get the parents out of the picture. It was easy. I usually get rid of the people who are annoying very fast in the book. By page 60, usually there are no beautiful women in my books. They have all died.
Why get rid of the beautiful women? Why is that annoying?
Oh, because they're annoying. They're terribly annoying. Thin women are annoying.
I wish you would. The book is narrated. It's in the voice of the granddaughter who is in trouble, and we'll describe that trouble. I wonder if you'd read a bit for us right off the top here, Isabel Allende, from Maya's notebook, the opening bit of a paragraph here.
Let me find the glasses.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
A week ago, my grandmother gave me a dry-eyed hug at the San Francisco airport and told me again that if I valued my life at all, I should not get in touch with anyone I knew until we could be sure my enemies were no longer looking for me. My Nini is paranoid, as the residents of the People's Independent Republic of Berkeley tend to be, persecuted as they are by the government and extremists. But in my case, she wasn't exaggerating. No amount of precaution could ever be enough. She handed me a 100-page notebook so I could keep a diary, as I did from the age of 8 until I was 15, when my life went off the rails. You're going to have to time lots of time to get bored, Maya. Take advantage of it to write down the monumental stupidities you've committed. See if you can come to grips with them, she said.
The grandmother's talking tough with her young American granddaughter, who's conceding right here in your opening lines, Isabel Allende, that her life had gone off the rails. Explain to us, describe to us the trouble that a bit that she gets into in Maya's notebook.
Well, when she's 16, the love of her life, her grandfather, dies of pancreatic cancer. The grandmother, who adores this man, goes into a depression. The parents are absent, and so the girl feels abandoned. And she ends up hooks up with the wrong friends and starts doing silly things at the beginning. Then it's drugs and alcohol, and she gets in trouble, deep trouble. Eventually, she will run away from home and end up in Las Vegas, where she gets in touch with a gang of drug dealers, and then her life really turns bad. She ends up homeless, doing drugs and alcohol, addicted, ill, very, very ill. And then the grandmother intervenes right in time, saves her, sends her to Chile, to an island in the southern part of Chile, where she will be not communicated at all with anybody, because the grandmother says you can't even use internet. People are after you. And there she starts to look at her own soul, reflect, and get involved with a rural community of very simple people who adopt her.
And when you say the southern part of Chile, if we picture the map of the world in South America, that is very far south indeed. That's the other end of the world.
As south as you can get. Yeah. Chile ends, at the south part of Chile, there's many archipelagos and fjords and islands. And this part, Chiloé, is beautiful. It has lousy weather, but it's gorgeous.
Chiloé, a little tiny island there. She sends her back, and suddenly you were talking about this bucolic rural setting. I mean, this book, Maya's notebook, is very contemporary in its drugs and street life and, you know, sort of leans toward prostitution here, and you've got crime and all the rest. But in another way, it's almost like, you remember the old story of Heidi, take the girl who's in trouble and send her off to grandfather's home in the mountains.
Tom.
Well, you've got your pastoral idol here.
No, because the island is no paradise. First of all, as I said, it's very far away, remote. When there's bad weather, you can't communicate. You don't have a signal for the phone or the internet. Then there is alcoholism, unemployment, incest, domestic violence.
Yes.
No, it's no paradise, no Heidi.
No, but still it's where the grandmother sends her daughter to find her feet again, as if the old country
has
some
kind. No, she sends her there because she thinks it's so far away that no one will ever find her.
What? I have to say, I think that sort of image of the old country having some special healing magic flows through here, even with all the problems on your little island. Don't you see some of that dynamic?
Yeah, because there is a sense of community, and that is what Maya has lost. Maya had a community when her grandparents were with her. She had a wonderful community that sustained her and gave her all the inner structure that she will need to get out of addiction. So she has all that has been given to her and that she loses temporarily. then in the island, she will find another form of community, but it's also very strong relationships. You really have to get involved with people to be accepted.
In a way, this granddaughter is standing in for a generation beyond your half-dozen grandchildren. I mean, who's lost here? Is it immigrant kids who are lost? Is it all kids, American kids who are lost? Is it this particular girl who's lost?
This particular girl, because I'm not preaching to a generation, but I've seen this group of young people that are like a sample of a whole generation, and they are in trouble.
Isabel Allende's new book is Maya's Notebook. She joins us today from San Francisco. We're going to dive right on into this book and a lifetime of work. Behind us here, Abre tu Ventana by Victor Jara. His music was popular during the Chilean socialist President Salvador Allende's term. Distant relative of my guest today. We'll look at that and its echo in Maya's Notebook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Tu risa brota como la mañana.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Isabel Allende about youth, age, wisdom, old countries, pierced noses, and her new novel, Maya's Notebook. She joins us today from San Francisco. You can read an excerpt of the new novel at our website, onpointradio.org. Isabel, lots of response already online for you. Elizabeth writes to us, I love the magic and myths in her novels. And as a Chilean, many of her stories remind me of the painful past of the military dictatorship in Chile. We'll speak
she
to
will
that.
Find all that in this book, actually.
It's here.
Because, you know, the part of Chile that I'm talking about, the South Chiloé, has a very unique mythology that was not sort of contaminated by the Catholic Church. It's very unique in the whole of Latin America. So all the magic comes from there.
You have a great gathering of good witches at a big point of woman power,
you know,
in this book.
I did attend one of the meetings of the witches, and it was wonderful.
Describe that.
Wonderful.
I mean, I read it in the book, but what is that? What's that tradition about?
No, it's not a tradition. It's just a group a circle of women, that young women in this case. Mm-hmm. I have my own circle, but we are all crones, hags. And these are all beautiful young women who get together in this sacred place that they call the Ruca or El Ruco, which is like a kiva. There they meet with a full moon. And they call it the gathering of witches, although what they do there is just hug each other and be together, support each other in the things that happen in life, you know.
In the book, they're naked and they're healing one another and they're open to one another. Is that what you saw?
And they are led, by an older woman who has had a double mastectomy, and so she has no breasts. Mm-hmm. And they are all naked, and it's just gorgeous, beautiful.
Here, Luisa also writes, she says, love her. Read her in Spanish. I started with La Casa de los Espíritus, House of Spirits. She captures the Latin American experience, the experience of exile, a feeling like another world could not have existed but did, the experience of adjusting to the United States. That's quite vivid here as well. I wonder how you're thinking of that this week, Isabel Allende, as we see this painful story out of Chechnya.
It's such a painful story. I think of the victims and the horror that we saw on TV, but I also think of the family of these kids, these men, and the horrible pain and shame that they must be feeling. The family is forever tainted. Future generations will have to carry this karma forever. It's just awful.
But I thought of you as I read your book up against the news of these revelations about these two young brothers and the mother's concerns, how she had tried, in a way that almost parallels your story, she had tried to bring her older son. She was afraid of where his life was headed, maybe too much pot, and she tried to get him back to the old religion. And even he was back, you know, in Dagestan with his father for 6 months last year. The FBI now looking at that. But some of that impulse to go back to the old ways, what was
to
there
rescue them
in this family? Yes, in their rescue effort. But there's no guarantee of that
I think
working.
That we have the crazy idea that everything from the past is better, which is not true. If I have to choose a time to live, it would be the future, never the past. But there are some things that I brought from my country, from my past, that I think are very useful at certain moments in life. A sense of family, of community, of honor. The fact that you have to be responsible and reliable and honorable. I think the word honor has been misused, but it is very important to bring up kids and to hold together a family.
Is there?
When I came to the United States, mm-hmm. I came to a very dysfunctional family. My American husband had a very dysfunctional family, and I wanted to put together an extended family like the one I had when I was growing up and I had lost as a political refugee in Venezuela and then as an immigrant in the United States. So I started gathering around me people that were not blood related but had the same values, the same sense of honor, the same principles, the same longing for family. And we put together this tribe. So when I dedicate the book to the children in the tribe, it's not only my children, mm-hmm. it's the children of these people that have put together an extended family.
Let us hear the voice a little more of Maya, the granddaughter in this book, who is shipped off to very remote island in Chile to get out of trouble. But before she goes, she's writing in here about the group of girls that she'd come to associate with in high school, Sarah and Debbie and her. Maya, could you read a little bit of the sort of downward spiral that they got into for us here?
Yeah, they were called the vampires. You can imagine
vampires,
how bad they
yeah,
were.
Yeah.
The three of us competed in a bad behavior contest. We'd established a system of points for offenses we got away with, consistent basically of destroying other people's property, selling marijuana, ecstasy, LSD, and stolen prescription drugs, spray painting the school walls, paying with forged checks, and shoplifting. We kept our scores in a notebook, counted them up at the end of the month, and whoever had the most got the price of a bottle of the strongest and cheapest vodka on the market, a Polish one that could also be used as paint thinner. My friends boasted of their promiscuity, venereal infections, and abortions as if they were badges of honor, although in the time we spent together, I didn't see any of that. By comparison, my prudishness was embarrassing, so I hurried to lose my virginity and did it with Rick Laredo, the dumbest dumbass on the planet.
Isabella Allende, reading from Maya's notebook there in the voice of the narrator, the young granddaughter who's in trouble. You write at one point in this book, her father was an airline pilot, and I forget if it's he or somebody's thinking that the problem with air travel is that the speed of air travel, you actually outrun your soul and you lose
the
it.
The soul is left behind.
The soul is left behind. Your
By
soul
the time
is
you get there, yes, you have no soul.
If you travel too much, you're in trouble. You can't even find it anymore. But are you suggesting in this story that the United States itself has some of that problem? I mean, look at
the speed in which we live.
Yeah?
We have no silence. We are all the time connected, informed, entertained, stimulated. Noise, noise, noise. It never stops. What Maya finds in the island is silence and time to reflect. Time to get bored. We need to get bored in order to be creative. In this country, no one can ever be bored. It's terrible.
I mean, you say it's not a Heidi story, but I've got her waking up at 7 in the morning and Manuel stoking up the fire in the stove to heat the water.
And it's freezing cold,
it's cold
and there's no water and there are no doors.
But they arrive with a splendid breakfast of eggs laid by her hens, bread fresh out of her oven, foamy warm milk from the cow. It's got a peculiar order, which I found a bit gross, but now love smells of stables, pasture.
Listen, you would not survive a week in Chiloé.
Oh, get out of town. This sounds great to me. I love it. But you write in her voice, on this bucolic island in Chiloé, the agitation of my past in the United States seems incomprehensible. I don't know what that inner disquiet was that used to give me no respite. Why I jump from one thing to the next, always looking for something, never knowing what. I can't manage to clearly remember those urges and feelings from the last 3 years, as if the Maya Vidal, her name, of that time was another person. It makes it sound like we all need to go on some bucolic retreat and we'll be okay, Isabel.
Just disconnect your phone.
Is this something? Chile also has a modern economy. It also has a...
Of course, and the rest of Chile is not like Chiloé. Mm-hmm. It's not like that island. In those islands, it's winter for 9 months of the year.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to do because people live off agriculture or they're fishermen. And so there's very little to do in winter when the storms keep you inside. So people have to gather around a stove and tell stories and gossip and hate each other also because they're all contained in this small space. So it's not paradise, let me tell you.
This girl,
but
not, yeah.
There is silence. That's for sure. There is silence.
Which
and time.
Yes.
Time stretches.
Yes. This girl, Maya, with her Danish mother, doesn't look very... she looks very Scandinavian, and they don't recognize her as a Latina.
Yeah, she's taller by a head from everybody in the island.
But when she first responds to somebody there, you know, asking about, how she looks, she responds in Spanish. And the Chilean on this island of Chiloé says, "De gringuita speaks Christian."
Yeah.
What is that? It was, speaks Christian means speaks Spanish on this little island?
Yeah, we say, hablan cristiano. Speak Spanish, of course.
Spanish equals Christian. Okay. Isabel Allende is with us. What a delight. Her new book is Maya's Notebook, and it is right up to date. Let's go to our listeners, if we may, Isabel. Mishi is calling from Watertown, famous Watertown, Massachusetts. Mishi, mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hola, Isabel.
Hola.
So happy to speak with you. I lived in Chile from 1971 until after the coup d'etat, which we should point out was on September 11th, 1973, and happened largely because of the role of our government. And I'm a lover of Chiloé and Sioux mythology and of the compassion, Isabel, that you have for your characters. So appreciate everything you've written. And I just wanted to share that very soon, I'm going to be trying to do what you do in terms of bridging these worlds across time and space by creating a way for students in U.S. high schools to learn the history of our country's foreign policy and how it impacted democracy and human rights in Chile and Central America and elsewhere. With so many Latino and Latina students in our classrooms, the fact that this story is not being taught is not good for any of us. So I just wanted you to know that.
Of the Cold War history, when the U.S. was very tough on left-leaning governments and movements.
Yeah, the world was divided in two halves, the area of influence of the Soviet Union and the area of influence of the United States. And we, Chile, were part of the United States. In that sense.
Sphere of power and influence. Mishi, I thank you for your call. That president of Chile, who overthrown in a coup there, Salvador Allende, your first cousin once removed. And remind us, those politics come into play in your new book, Isabel Allende. How?
Yeah, because there is a character. I don't want to reveal much because that's part of the suspense of the novel. Mm-hmm. I tried to create... a sort of the structure of a crime novel. So there is suspense there after the girl. Will they find the girl? What will happen if they find her, etc.? So I don't want to reveal the ending. But there is a character in the book that receives Maya in the island. Why is this man who is a hermit, who doesn't want to be with anybody, who lives in a house without doors, who is an old man that is grouchy, why would he receive this teenager in trouble that he doesn't even know? So that's also part of the mystery of Maya's past. And this man has been tortured and is traumatized by his own past. And so Maya will discover slowly things about his character and about his past that will allow her to discover at the same time the past of Chile that is hidden because people don't want to talk about it.
Our caller, Mishi, says, let's speak of it, in particular with young Americans of Latin American descent. Adela in Milford, Connecticut, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Isabel Allende.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Isabel. Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
I say a pleasure. I'm calling because I love your work. I'm very familiar. I'm from Spain, but my family lives in Mexico City. I've been in Chile, and I'm an educator, and this is an outreach. With your novel, it's an outreach for Hispanic kids to be acquainted with good literature, with actual facts that they live, but also the Hispanic kids that they are looking for identity in this country, because they have their parents, they have their culture, but at the same time they are living, as we know, a lot of different kind of immigration. And by them having a book where, first of all, teach them how a nice literature is, what a good literature is, they can relate to this. And unfortunately, before all this was taboo in Latin America and Hispanic world, all the drugs, all this kind of situations, but now every country is living it. It is all Americanized. And all the kids that are Hispanic in this country are experiencing it. And putting it in this book like that, I think it's going to reach a lot of kids, and also bringing the cultural identity to them, and also talking about the analogy that you made about, I think, Tom, you made an analogy with the situation of the
brothers in the last week.
The brothers. I mean, the immigration part. Well, I live in Spain, where a lot of terrorism is. And I think that all of what is happening around this these high schoolers and middle schoolers, I think they can relate, they can see, they can reflect. Something that I like from the book is asking for reflection.
Yeah, Adela, we're coming up on a break, but I'm grateful for your call. It's great to have you.
I just want to say one little thing. Mm-hmm. That thank you very much for pointing out that kids would be interested. Because although this is not a young adult novel, the theme is about teenagers. So I do hope that I will have new young readers.
At 70, Isabel Allende says, come on in. It's all here.
Why do you have to say my age, Tom? That's not polite.
Hey, come on. You're proud. I know you're proud. I know you're proud and you should be. It's great to have you with us. And it's part of the way that wisdom can be made, right? Time can contribute to that, or at least we can hope, anyway. Isabel Allende's new book, Maya's Notebook, is excerpted at our website. You can read a bit there. Here's Gracias a la Vida by Violeta Parra. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto. Me dio el corazón que agita su marco. Cuando miro el fruto del cerebro humano, cuando miro el bueno tan lejos del malo, cuando miro el fondo de tus ojos claros.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Isabel Allende about youth, age, wisdom, old countries, pierced noses, and her new novel, Maya's Notebook. There's a grandmother, a Chilean-American grandmother, who sends the granddaughter back to Chile after she gets into drugs and alcohol and big trouble and the pierced nose and the many-colored hair and the pink combat boots and all the rest. And on a tiny little island near the other end of the world, she finds something like a renewal. Isabel Allende joins us today from San Francisco. You know, I'd love to hear just a little bit more of this, Isabel, if you would read. You described earlier this meeting of women at night, and they're sort of just leaving all men aside and away, and they're naked and they're eating almonds and figs, and they're talking about things that are important to one another.
Yeah. You make it sound much better than it really was.
Well, I mean, she says it looks like a scene from the 1001 Arabian Nights, so it sounds pretty good. But read a little bit to give us
your male imagination.
I know your female imagination has gone to that those 1001 Nights too. Could you read a bit?
Okay, I'll read some. Yeah. They talked of their dreams, illnesses, fears, and hopes. They laughed, some cried, and all applauded Blanca because her recent test results confirmed that her cancer was still in remission. A young woman whose mother had just died asked if they could sing for her soul, and another, with a silvery voice, began a song, with everyone else joining in for the chorus. Just after midnight, Blanca suggested we conclude the meeting by honoring our ancestors. Then each of us named someone, the recently deceased mother, a grandmother, a godmother, and described the legacy that person had left them. For one, it was artistic talent. For another, a natural medicine recipe book. For the third, a love of science. And around it went until everyone told theirs. I was the last. And when my turn came, I named my grandfather, my Popo, but my voice wouldn't cooperate to tell these women who he was. Afterward, there was a silent meditation with eyes closed to think about the ancestors we'd invoked, thank them for their gift, and say goodbye. That's what we were doing when I remembered the phrase my Popo had repeated to me for years. Promise me that you will always love yourself as much as I love you, Maya. The message was as clear as if he had said it to me out loud. I began to cry and kept crying, the ocean of tears that hadn't flowed when he died.
Isabel Allende reading from Maya's notebook. You just about made me cry there. Those women had something good going on in that wonderful.
I went there with my daughter-in-law when we visited Chiloé the last time for the book, and we met these women in the Ruka. It was such a magical evening. It was unforgettable, and I just describe it exactly as it happened. I only had to put Maya in there.
Is there something that women can only share? Without men?
Well, men drum in the forests, yeah. Don't they? Yeah. In West Marin,
where I live.
Yeah.
I've heard.
They dance naked with drums.
All right. Sesame in New York, Chatham, New York is calling. Sesame, you're on the air with Isabel Allende. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you so much. And I just want to, first of all, say that I'm a Mexican-American and also Gypsy, the Roma. So I came from two very distinct, different cultural backgrounds.
Yeah.
And it was my grandmother who intervened in my life when I was on that path of destruction. I was very much into drugs and alcohol and really, you know, trying to destroy myself. And I had no identity. And I remember learning when I was a child that, you know, the dirty Mexicans, you know, we're not part of them. And so I think I had a sort of, you know,
What did your grandmother do? How did she help you?
People. She was, well, how she helped me was she was very direct with me, but she loved me unconditionally. You know, she wouldn't tolerate my craziness, but she took me in and she would nurse me back to health and she would pray. She would pray.
Well, that's lovely.
She would pray. Yeah.
So this is a story that you can resonate very directly with, Sesame. She brought that power to work for you, your grandmother.
Yes. Thank God for the grandmother.
Yes, I say here to that. Absolutely. Let me get thank you, Sesame. Alejandro in West Palm Beach, Florida. Thank you for calling, Alejandro. You're on the air.
Thank you. Doña Isabel, un honor. It's an honor.
Gracias.
Have you there. I've read your books and everything. And I would ask you, through all your trajectory, one of the things I faced with my sons and family on the drugs of the province, and that is most of the values, the culture we used to receive in the schools, don't matter how humble they were, was the morale and principles that people live by. Which, by the way, where you mentioned the song of Parra, Doy Gracias a la Vida, which mm-hmm. is one in which doesn't matter how you lived, it's not a material thing. It's that what the person learned and what how she lived that she thanked God for what she got on her life. How would you state for all our American continent and the rest of the world to go back to those principles in the education and the basic education to build back a culture with the new principles of women's leave and all that, but how would you implement in the schools where and when so that kids don't have that conflict of the that they're going through in?
Alejandro, our time is short. Let me take it to Isabel. How do we get the best of the old, but also the new, women's rights and so on, is Alejandro asks Isabel.
I think that basically education is pretty good in this country and in the world. And what happens is that there is no sense of authority. So although the curriculum is there and the education is possible for everybody, kids get away with hell. I mean, they when I was growing up and when my children were growing up, you couldn't disrespect your teachers. I'm not saying that you have to go back to slapping them, although sometimes it's pretty useful. But at least there should be some sense of authority, of respect, which has been completely lost. That teachers and parents are afraid of kids. The kids get away with whatever they want. There is one point when somebody asked me the other day, well, if there's one lesson that Maya learns, what is it that she learns in the island? And Maya learns one lesson that is essential, that our kids have forgotten: reciprocity. You have to give back as much as you get. The fact that you take from life and from people and from the country and from, and you don't give anything back is impossible. That is unsustainable. And so she learns in the island that this law of reciprocity, in which if you receive something, you have to give back, maybe not to the same person, but you have to give back something of the same value to another person. So it becomes like a chain mm-hmm. of giving and receiving.
That's a beautiful law. Interestingly, though, you mentioned authority. She also learns how authority can go wrong and did in Chile's own history, brutally.
Yeah, yeah.
Do your grandchildren, your extended tribe, the young members of your tribe, want to hear these messages, Isabella?
No, of course not. They think I'm totally nuts. They don't talk to me.
Oh, I bet they do. I bet they come around. I bet they want to hear your stories.
I don't think so. But I write them down, and sooner or later they will have to read them.
Well, this is a good one. We're glad you brought it. We're glad you've come out of the pages of history and so up to date. And we're glad you've come back to On Point to talk with us. It's always great
Thank
to have
Tom.
You.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much. Good luck, Isabel.
Good luck to you.
Isabel Allende, international best-selling author of the new book, Maya's Notebook. Of course, so many others as well. Island Beneath the Sea, Eva Luna, The House of Spirits, Zorro in 2005. Creator of the Isabel Allende Foundation to empower women and girls around the world. In a moment, we will be remembering Woodstock legend Richie Havens, looking back to a conversation we had with him in 2005. This is On Point. Singer and guitarist Richie Havens died yesterday at his home in Jersey City, New Jersey. He was 72. With his earthy voice and bohemian way, Havens caught something essential about the 1960s. His fame was made when he improvised riffing the song Freedom to open Woodstock. In 2005, I spoke with Richie Havens about that iconic moment in 1969 when he took the stage. He spoke about arriving by helicopter, flying over the sea of spectators.
It was a Neiman painting, you know? All these splashes of color. And interestingly enough, you know, the young guys on radio now, they say, oh, 500,000 people. The fact of the matter is there was 500,000 people the first day when I got there. The newspapers, of course, said 250,000, you know, because they did that to us always. They always cut us in half.
But it was big from the beginning, you
say. It was big from the beginning. There were people up there for 2 weeks camping before it even happened. And a lot of them were sitting in the field with their tickets waiting for it to start, and they never even had to give their tickets in because there was no fence anyway. It was free.
And when you when you got through all those hours and you came to this improvisation at the end, and freedom is the word, and who wouldn't feel it?
Well, you know, that was actually the last song.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Because they actually chased me for an hour and a half to go on first. I ran like heck. I was going, they're not going to kill me on that stage because the concert's like 12 hours late. I'm out of here, you know. Right. And I ran, you know. So I hit a few times, and they finally, you know, convinced me to go on. And when I did, the people were so glad that anything was happening, as far as I'm concerned. I walked out, and they were very happy something was going to happen. And it dawned on me, you know, when I flew over them, I said to myself, if this picture makes the newspapers tomorrow, we will have won. Because now we could really count them from whatever they say. What people don't realize is when they see the movie and they see the hill with the people standing up and starting to clap during that song, at the top of that hill was a road. And on the other side of that hill was a field just as big as the one we were looking at, filled with people who never saw the stage.
And you knew it because you'd just
flown over
it. And it, so and a moment
here we
was
are.
Made.
I go up on the stage, I start singing, and everybody was supposed to be like 30 minutes. So I walked off at 30 minutes, and they go, Richie, nobody's here yet. Can you do four more? No problem. You know, I could do four more. I went back. Well, I went back six times. Six
and
times.
And it was 2 hours and
45
minutes.
It was 2 hours and 45 minutes later. I walk off for the sixth time, and they say, Richie, one more. So I go back to the stage and I sit down and I'm playing. If you watch the movie, I'm still playing the last song that I walked off with. Yeah. I sit down and I start tuning my guitar and I'm going, I don't know one more song I could sing. And so that long intro is me stalling to figure out what I was going to do.
And then
what came to me was I was looking at the freedom that my entire generation had been looking for since the 50s. That means that I do believe that my generation was a very special generation in that the world changed around us and also within us because we were the last speak when you're spoken to generation.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant we needed to exercise our voice. Well, that became what we call today rock and roll. And that was the 50s. It wasn't the 60s. We were speaking out about our situations as teenagers in the 50s. And that in and of itself, as they, you know, they block off blocks of 10, you know, this was the 50s, this is the 60s,
right.
This is the 70s. Well, they don't mention that it was the same kids in the 50s that became the kids in the 60s that realized they had a voice.
And one of them
that they could,
was you.
Well, that's the way it happened.
Young Richie
Hayes.
That's
the way it happened. That is really my life. I have been inspired by the songs I sing personally. So it's not very difficult for me to keep singing them. I could sing them for 100 years because I think we're still in the part of the becoming when we need ammunition. We need information. We need inspiration. And that's what these kinds of songs give us. They are our fuel. In that sense. And they're my fuel, too. I don't feel any different than anyone else on this planet. And I know that if it does something for me, possibly it could do something for others as well. So, that yes, I will be doing the scissor kick for another 10 years.
And that hard strum you do, can you keep that up forever? Boy, it must be murder on the fingers and knuckles.
It isn't really. You know something? The weirdest part about what I do is the guitar is the last thing I think about. I don't even think of myself as a guitar player. I think of myself as creating the music I need to sing the songs that actually changed me. So I really don't think about my guitar playing. It is purely the body metronome for what I do. That foot that's moving on the left side of the stool. I would say if you cut off that foot, the hand doesn't work anymore.
You know, the body metronome.
Kind of frustrated drummer, you know. Yeah. And also having sung doo-wop and knowing harmony, yeah. I was really able to tune the guitar the way I felt I could use it, and I'm still doing it that way. I mean, this is the only way I know how.
Richie Havens, speaking with me in 2005. Richie Havens died yesterday from a heart attack at 72. We go out with Richie Havens performing his cover of George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun at the Cellar Door in Washington, D.C. in 1970. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Richie Havens. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's all right.